Okay, it's 3 p.m. I'm calling on the 29th Pat Mizenik meeting to order. Pat, can you verify the form?
We do have a form. Thank you again for remembering. You can pick that attendance sheet and look at every spot, and thank you, Phil, for collecting those at the end of the meeting. Thank you also for remembering how important it is to go to a microphone if you want to raise a comment or ask a question. And it helps us if you tell us your name first. Thanks.
And also just add, if you haven't picked up a clicker, please do, we have a clicker there. So can I have a motion to adopt the agenda for today's meeting? Question on it, you have a second? Second, any discussion? No, can we have a vote? All in favor of adopting the agenda, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Can I have a motion to approve minutes for the November 1st, 2023, Pat Mizenik meeting? First? Second, Marsh? Any discussion or corrections or deletions? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the November 1st, 2023 minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? All right, the minutes are approved. Pat, do you have any questions or comments?
No public comment today.
So moving on to item six, Pat Mizenik president's announcements. I know we've got a lot to cover today, so I'm going to try and be brief. But first, I wanted to mention that Executive Vice President Provost Search
is underway with a position posted widely. As part of that process, we would like to receive any nominations from those on campus, from your networks, for those who may be interested in the position or you deem to be a good fit. If you could please send those nominations to myself or to co-chair Streb, or I will send out a nomination link in my follow-up email. And as you likely saw in an announcement, criteria 1 and 2 for the HLC assurance agreement is now available for review. So if you could please take the time to review that and add any examples to make our case the best that it can be. I wanted to provide a quick update on the survey that I had asked everybody to go back to your constituent groups and bring back information related to professional development or other information that you may find valuable or your constituents may find valuable prior and at November 1st Faculty Senate meeting. I've gone through those results and I've got a bunch of action items for me, so I may stop with the surveys for a little bit so I stop getting more work for myself to do. But there was an overwhelming desire for more information, training, and transparency related to the budget. This includes defining what the structural deficit is, understanding the processes and values behind the decision making, resource allocation, where money is being spent proportionally across university and so on. And I've been in conversation with CFO Middlemist and EVPB Elish Piper, and they've come to this group and we're engaged in ongoing conversations. They'll be coming back again to share budget updates in the spring. And I know they're also working to pull together resources to bring more transparency and insights into this process, but I will continue from my seat to continue learning and sharing with this group as we have more information, and ensuring that that we all, I think the concern or the request is echoed by George and Lori both, for building transparency and trust in the budgeting process. Curricular decisions was also an area that was flagged by multiple groups. So I'll be working together to see how we can bring together more information about this process to share in this setting. I will also be pulling this together and I'll share it in the recap as well. But there was information to learn more about sponsored projects and opportunities for internal supports for research. There were also, those are the main areas related to professional development and for research of tenured faculty, was finding more pots of money, more internal grant competitions, and learning more about sponsored projects, processes. For teaching and librarianship, There is a number of asks about AI, both in terms of how to use it for teaching, but also how to engage with students using it, both in terms of the stuff that they turn in, as well as how do we prepare our students to better use AI in the careers that they'll be pursuing. And so that's something I'm going to start talking with Jason Rohde and Stephanie Richter about to see if CITL has some insights or has plans in place to support. I know we're exploring using the AI Blackboard tool for course development, but to see if there's other resources that we can share here, they can come and talk to us about or put together resources for us. And then another related to service, there are multiple flags for continued and expanded efforts for mentoring, shadowing, and training for leadership positions for folks who are thinking about going into various leadership positions. So I will continue engaging with those who offer those to make sure that they're available and widely communicated. And there was also multiple times faculty reporting a desire to learn more about how to do outreach and community building and building partnerships with external stakeholders. And I know this is a topic that the Engagement Roundtable, which is co-chaired by EVPP Elish Piper and I always forget the thing, but VP Cochones out of Outreach, the Chief Engagement Officer, is taking up at that Engagement Roundtable. And so more information will be shared as that becomes available out of that group. And finally, there's been asked for more information. This is something I'll be taking on in the new year around more information and professional development about what is shared governance, defining it, identifying routes and connection points, defining roles and responsibilities, and how it all works together. And I'll be taking that on from the Faculty Senate side of things in the new year. And my final announcement before I move on to item 7 is I wanted to let folks know that about proposals that will be coming before this body in the next calendar year, so in January, related to making Faculty Senate bylaws governing promotion and tenure more inclusive and in better alignment with our university mission, vision, and values. One aspect of this work is related to clinical and research faculty. So the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee recently took up the recommendations of a working group on this topic, and they passed a recommendation to amend the Faculty Senate bylaws to include promotion criteria, guidelines, and processes in the Faculty Senate bylaws, which currently there are no Faculty Senate bylaws governing the promotion process of clinical and research faculty. So this will make sure that that key and important group of faculty are included in our bylaws. The Faculty Senate Social Justice Committee will also be considering a proposal to amend Article 8 of the Faculty Senate bylaws in alignment with the work they've been engaged with over these past 2 years. And as part of this larger package of work to make the bylaws more inclusive and better aligned with mission, vision, and values will be efforts to include specific language indicating teaching, scholarship, and service that is transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, or engaged is valued here at this institution. And so while this will all come as a package to this body in the new year, if anybody in the meantime would like to learn more about it, has any questions, or want to engage in a conversation with me, please feel free to use my office hours, which I'll share again, or just reach out and we can find a time to talk about all of these efforts being pulled together. That's a lot for me, but that's the end of my announcements. So with that, we proceed to item 7, which is the provost announcement. So I'll invite Lori up.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Hopefully everyone had a good Thanksgiving. We're back for the home stretch here. I have three quick announcements, one of which I've shared before, but it's about book adoptions. We're currently at 67% of our spring classes have texts adopted or have been identified as requiring no text. And so I just want to remind folks to take the message back to your colleagues to ensure that we get more of those texts adopted because of the holiday, because of the way that a lot of books are now printed on demand. Any text adoptions received after December 6th cannot be guaranteed to be available by the start of classes. So we really do want to you know, hit that target date. So if you can carry that back to your constituents, that would be helpful. Also have an update regarding general education. I'm going to read it because it's a little complicated, and I want to make sure that I express it correctly. So the General Education Committee undertook an extensive two-year evaluation of the Pathways Program, which is an optional completion of selected general education courses in seven areas that fulfill the knowledge domain requirements. The result of that analysis led the committee to conclude that pathways were not an enticing avenue for students, and they were not completing them. At the October 19th meeting, the General Education Committee voted to recommend that the Pathways program be eliminated, effective with the 2024-25 catalog. The Baccalaureate Council considered that recommendation at their November 9th meeting and approved the removal of the Pathways. All courses in the Pathways will remain as general education courses. Minutes of the General Education Committee and the Baccalaureate Council are posted online if you'd like to review that to see the discussions and recommendations in more detail. And if anyone has questions, they can reach out to Amanda Ferguson, the faculty chair of the Baccalaureate Council, Rod Coffrin, the chair of the General Education Committee, or Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, Alicia Shadaman. Also wanted to encourage folks to apply for or nominate others for the RIPS Star Academy. And the RIPS Star Academy, STAR stands for Strategic Transdisciplinary Art Research and Scholarship. And this is a professional development opportunity that focuses on faculty learning more and being better situated to secure external funding. This is offered through the Division of Research and Innovation Partnerships. And if you go to the Office of Research Development website, you can see more information. But the most important thing probably is the deadline, which is December 6th. So while the program is targeting early career faculty, all faculty are eligible. So if you or others in your area are interested, I urge you to apply. That concludes my announcements.
Thank you so much. So that brings us to item 8, which is new business, a proposal to amend guidelines and principles for establishment of the academic calendar and selected academic calendars to recommend that general election day be designated as administrative closure day on university holiday schedules. You can see this on pages 8 through 15 of your packet. So I'll read this out loud to everybody. So clarification of Senate Bill 2123 from the Illinois State Senate staff revealed that the holiday language relative to the Illinois general election day does not apply to colleges and universities. As a result, this administrative closure day was removed from the NIU university holiday schedule and also removed from the guidelines and principles for establishment of the academic calendar. This proposal would accomplish the following. It would restore the general election day as a day of no classes and guidelines and principles for establishment of the academic calendar, item 5, student faculty vacation periods and holidays. It would revise the reference to general election day in the already approved 2024-25, 2026-27, 2028-29, 2030-31, and 2032-33 academic calendars from university closed to no classes. And 3, it recommends to those authority over the university holiday schedule to give consideration to making the general election day as an administrative closure day in the current and future university holiday schedules. So NIU is engaged in many efforts related to voter education, voter registration, increasing voter participation rates among Huskies and in the broader community. While participating in the general election has been made easier through early voting and absentee voting, The designation of the general election day as a no classes day provides faculty and students an opportunity for civic engagement. The no classes day would allow students and faculty, many who are commuters to the DeKalb campus, to vote in their local elections and otherwise participate in the elections. Further, having no classes on the general election day would provide the message that NIU values civic engagement, particularly through exercising students and faculty's right to vote. While the no classes day provides greater opportunity for faculty and students to engage in the election, it does not provide the same opportunity to staff or those students who work on campus. The proposal includes the recommendation for making the general election day an administrative closure day in order to ensure the opportunity extends across campus. So before discussion, can I have a motion to approve the proposal? And a second? All right, any discussion? All
Evgeny Nestor of Chemistry. I'm just curious about the text you have read actually refers to the item 5 as university holiday and vacation, something like this. But then in the actual item 5, you see that that is crossed out and instead it's shown as no classes time. So what exactly is supposed to be there?
It it would be amended to say no class days, as the general election day is not a holiday. So we thought to make a more inclusive term there, we would say no class days rather than vacation periods and holidays, because we do not have, faculty centers not have the authority to create a holiday or a vacation period. So to be more accurate and precise, that would.
But I mean, in that text you have read, actually, the one in the sort of reasoning for this, it actually refers to vacation and holiday instead of no classes.
You're correct. I didn't carry it forward into that.
Okay.
It should under one, the first item, it should be item 5, no class days.
Okay. So, but that still means that staff will have to come to work, because that's a different item, pretty much different item completely, so we cannot consider that. Basically, university would be closed on a general election day rather than no classes.
It is, faculty senate does not have that authority.
Okay.
To close campus. We can make it a no classes day.
Yeah.
And that's why part of the recommendation, part of the proposal is to make the recommendation to those who do have that authority to make it an administrative closure day.
Because
we don't have that authority though.
Because typically, if no classes, it's kind of ambiguous, because we don't have classes, but we still come to work. Graduate students still come to do research and so on. So it's not the same as having university closed.
Correct. And there's other days that are similar where there's no classes. For instance, this past Wednesday, there was no classes, but the university could have still been open.
I'm Sarah Marsh from Department of Management. I just wanted to express my wholehearted support for this proposal. I surveyed my faculty, my department, and it was nearly unanimous that we, as an institution, we need to express our values. And that means taking all the educational opportunities to encourage our students to vote, create opportunities for our faculty and staff to vote, and that, you know, while myself as a faculty member have made considerable efforts to educate my students about how to vote, how to use all the tools that are available to them to vote, it means a lot more when I can say, here are all the tools, let's work through these. And the university thinks it's so important that they're closing the university for the day. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Sarah. Seeing no other movement towards the microphone, we will move to a vote, and we will use our clickers, and I'll turn to Pat to lead us through that.
Okay, so I think the first thing I'll do is go back to this page of voting members so that you can see if you're on that list, or if you're here today for someone who's on that list, that means you're a voting member. And special note, I think we have two new student members in the room today, and you're not on my list, but you are voting members too. So if you see your name there or you're here for someone whose name is on the list, make sure you have a clicker. Quick reminder that you don't need to turn the clickers on or off. They work automatically when you put your vote in. And in a minute, I'll open the poll. And when I do, I'll ask you to click 1 or A for yes, you agree with the motion to approve the proposal, or click 2 or B, no, you don't agree with the proposal, or 3C for abstain. And then you should get a check mark or a smiley face on your clicker to let you know that that vote was counted. So give me a second here to open that up for you. Okay, you can go ahead and vote now. 1 for yes, 2 or B for no, 3 or C for abstain. And I don't see any responses coming in. Did that not go through? I hate it when it doesn't work. Okay, let's all stop clicking. And I'm going to try to close that out. Let's try it again. Okay, well, that's never happened before, has it? All right, I'm going to try to close the whole system and just sort of reboot that. We'll see if that works. Okay. Okay, can you go ahead and click now? No.
On channel 45.
Channel 45, yeah, and I checked them all this morning. They should all be on channel 45. Okay, so we could do a voice vote, or we could do I have paper. We could pass out paper and do a ballot. We could do a raise hands.
I move for a voice vote.
Oh, okay, so a second.
Do we have a second for that? Second, Alan Tanner? All right, let's, do we do a voice vote on the voice vote, or do we just go straight to the voice
yes.
vote?
Yes.
All right.
That so was a good will, question.
We will move to a voice vote. All in favor of passing the proposal as stated in the packet, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? All right, it has passed. Thank you.
Okay, so that was the voice vote motion that passed, right?
Yes, so.
So now,
sorry, my fault. I confused myself. This is the actual vote for the proposal, not the vote, not the vote on the voice vote. All in favor of passing the proposal as written, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? All right, it's passed. Both parts are passed now. All right. Great. That will bring us to our next item, which now I just need to get back on track. So items for faculty senate consideration, item 9, the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action and its impact on NIU. We have with us General Counsel and Vice President Brian Perry. So if you would please come on up, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Before I get started, I just want to say, Ben, you got a little bit of an insight into my role as parliamentarian for the board. It's not as easy as it looks sometimes, is it? And although I usually don't appear before you, please don't blame me for breaking the clicker. So if I'm before you, I see a lot of friendly faces out there that I've gotten to know over the years, but if I have not met you, please, a couple minutes after the meeting, let's connect so I can put a name to a face and you get to know me. So I'm before you to talk about a pretty landmark case, and that case is the Students for Fair Admissions. And so we're going to get into that, and I'd rather have a conversation. I have slides, and it's going to be a part of your packet, but just sort of to talk about the case a little bit and why it's such a big deal. It's a big deal, first, because it changed the face of race-conscious admissions in the United States. For almost 50 years prior to this case, it's pretty well settled law that if a university wanted to achieve diversity, it was considered a compelling interest. And as long as those means to achieve diversity were narrowly tailored to get to that objective, the court said it was constitutional. And states agreed, and that really was the law of the land. There have been challenges over the years and gone to the Supreme Court, but every time, as long as the means to achieve a diverse class was narrowly tailored to achieve that, and compelling interest of diversity was considered by the court, Supreme Court, there hadn't been a problem. Until we get to this case, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and UNC. So there again, there have been a number of cases. Some of you may have even heard them in your studies of Bakke v. California and Fisher v. Texas and Grutter v. Bollinger. These are cases that all led up to Students for Fair Admissions. So the plaintiffs in this case alleged that the admissions practices at Harvard and UNC violated the Constitution because it unfairly used race as one of the criteria. The schools in the case argued, as they had every other university prior to this in cases before the Supreme Court, that their use of race was very narrowly tailored to help increase diversity. And up until this point, that had carried the day. Students for Fair Admissions argued no matter how narrowly tailored the means were to achieve diversity, diversity really was not a compelling interest for a university. It violated the Constitution, specifically the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution and Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. And Title VI, in a nutshell, says that if you receive federal funding, you can't discriminate. And so that was the argument. The schools argued, on like every other university prior to that, compelling interest, narrow means. Students for Fair Admissions argued that doesn't matter, you can't ever use race in admissions. So the case was argued on Halloween. Go back from there. Case was argued on Halloween. You can write your own joke, fill in your own commentary with that itself. But if you listen to the case, you knew pretty much 30 minutes in what the court was going to do and how they were going to rule. So after months of deliberations, we finally got an opinion on June 29th. I won't forget because I was at a conference of higher ed lawyers and we broke the internet because we were all trying to download this 252-page opinion. And the court did what many thought they would do. They overruled years of precedents and said that race could no longer be used in admissions. The opinion is very clear. The holding was very clear. Affirmative action that we had known it, had grown up on, had worked in, was no longer the law of the land. The specific holding of the court was not only was race no longer considered for admissions purposes, the educational benefits of diversity supported by race-conscious admissions is no longer considered a compelling interest. You can't measure diversity, which is kind of interesting. Just as a small footnote, the court says you can't sufficiently measure diversity, but in previous cases, if you said you would measure diversity and when it would be achieved, they considered that a quota and they would strike it down. So there really wasn't a way to win. And the court ruled that some groups were disadvantaged by the admissions programs. They considered it a zero-sum game. And there was no logical endpoint of when diversity would be achieved. Again, you can't measure it, don't know where it ends. So the court said, we didn't think it's vague enough that we cannot support this any longer. And he struck down race-conscious admissions. So after the case came out June 29th, the Department of Education said they would provide clarifying guidance later this summer on how to interpret the opinion and really why that's important to us. Is how the Department of Ed would enforce the opinion, how they interpreted the law, the opinion, and what we would need to be concerned about as universities. So in the end of August, they came out with the Dear Colleague letter, which is not really law, but it kind of is because they tell you this is how we see the law and some advice on things we could do. This was important because we were all waiting on this because although the opinion said that race-conscious admissions were unconstitutional, a lot of things the court didn't say in the opinion, and that created a lot of questions, a lot of vagueness. One of the things the court said in the opinion, which I think a lot of lawyers were trying to determine, was there was language by Chief Justice Roberts saying, you can't use race in an objective way and provide a preference in admissions, but students were allowed to talk about race as their lived experiences, and then holistic admissions process. So on one hand, you're saying you can't use race, but on the other hand, you're saying you can talk about it and trying to figure out how broad is that? And there are other areas that remain sort of vague or unclear. And so the hope was the Department of Ed would kind of come in and clean that up for us. These are the specific areas that the opinion failed to address in the SFA case. Scholarships and financial aid, outreach and recruitment, pipeline and pathway programs, data collection, does this extend to employment, and race-neutral strategies? Because although the court said you had to be race-neutral, it didn't say what that meant. And you know what happens when you leave stuff to interpretation? Everyone interprets it differently. And so we're looking for guidance around that. So the Dear Colleague letter came out, and these are some of the highlights. There are many things that the letter didn't address, but it did clarify some things that we thought, but now to have it in writing, it made our jobs a little bit easier in terms of providing advice. So some of the outreach and pathway programs, those are still okay, as long as they are open to all. NIU would always have been doing this. So for us, the reaction to the decision wasn't as dramatic as some institutions, because we've already been doing things that are in the best interest of our student population, and it didn't require race to be used in admissions or any of our other programs. So we were already on the other side of this, but still we needed to know how far the Department of Ed think this opinion extended, so we would have a good sense of what the landscape looked like. So again, pipeline, bridge programs, they didn't see an issue there. Outreach by race for specific groups. There's nothing wrong with creating a diverse student body if that is the mission of the school. What the clarifying Department of Ed memo said was that, again, you can do targeted outreach, but in the admissions process, that outreach can't lead to a preference based upon race. So if you target a particular zip code or high school and you partner with them, that's great, but that can't then translate into the admissions process where all the Black or the Latino students get an extra preference because of race and that connection to the school. And I think what's very important for us and the population of students we serve, data collection was also permissible. So you're allowed to get student data. Ironically, although you can't use race in admissions, you can still put race on your application. You can still have it on the application process and on the Common App. You just can't use it in the process. So you're kind of, it's a very murky area that you can still have race, because the challenge is if you can't prove that something you didn't do. So if you have it, it's a good chance you may get a challenge. But if you don't have it, you don't have the data. So it's sort of this balancing act to figure out where do you ask the right questions to get the data you need. But collecting data, the Department of Ed said, is still permissible under the opinion. And I think there's language in the Supreme Court opinion that supports that as well. This is the one that I think we're waiting on in the next set of cases. Affirmative action as it relates to hiring. There's very strong language by some of the justices in the opinion that this case really should be expanded to any instance of affirmative action. So while the court did not specifically rule beyond admissions, there's enough language that suggests you'll start seeing cases related to affirmative action programs in employment. And in fact, you're already seeing them. I know several lawsuits have been filed against law firms and their programs around creating more diverse class of associates and lawyers at law firms. So you're beginning to see these things. And race-conscious scholarships, which I'll get more in detail. So this opinion came out in June. Since June 29th, I know of at least 12 schools that have gotten complaints filed against them because of that second piece, using race for scholarships. And that is, I think, probably the biggest gray area. Admissions, I think, is pretty clear. And to be honest, I think if you've worked in any other institutions outside of public, you know, but the majority of schools, admissions already have moved to test blind. A lot of schools have moved to a Common App. And we all know the demographics. We are fighting for students. So race really wasn't an issue except for more elite schools and really selective admission schools. So we weren't impacted there so much. But the tentacles relating to scholarships, that is where the biggest battle is going to be over the next few years. So what is still unclear, like I said, is what race neutral alternatives are permitted. Still unclear. And neither the Supreme Court or Department of Ed have clearly articulated whether federal financial aid and race conscious scholarships are still permitted. The court, again, did not address that. But the lawsuits are coming, and I think it's naive to suggest that you're not going to see groups attacking race conscious scholarships. So the work we're doing at NIU is we are first trying to get a handle on all the scholarships that we have, because there's so many in each college that I don't think there's been one catalog of all scholarships. So we're trying to see just how many we have. Out of the scholarships, we're putting them in different buckets. There's a green bucket, which is the easiest. Merit-based, need-based, there's no racial component whatsoever. Then there's a yellow bucket where plenty of criteria other than race, but race may be a small factor. And so we're looking at those to see, what is the goal? Because there may be ways to achieve this goal without explicitly addressing race in the awarding of that scholarship, still retain a diverse pool of applicants and diverse awardees. And then there's a red bucket, which I don't think we have a lot of, knock on wood. And those are the ones where the only component is race. We know those are going to be targeted, and those are the ones that we have to make a decision on how we're going to handle. And the way we're approaching this work is looking at the goal and the objective, because there are so many factors given our student population that we can look to outside of race. I don't think there's any financial aid award that we offer where we can't find a way to do it on a race-neutral basis. So the first activity is just figuring out what we have available and then beginning to see what level of work we need to do. I met with the deans this morning, so they're already doing that work. I've met with Roundtable, with my colleague, Dr. Sumner. So this is work that is ongoing since the case was decided in June, and also the NIU Foundation. So I expect to be back before you again, because even since this case, there was one exception that the court made in race-based admissions, and that was for the military academies. Since the filing and the ruling in that case, the Students for Fair Admissions group have now sued the military academies to have that exemption removed. So it's a good chance, and in probably 2 years, as that case makes its way through, the Supreme Court will then clarify all these vague questions that we have, and it may not be in a positive way. So again, we're trying to be proactive now and do the work. One, because we always want to make sure we're on the right side of the law, but also we want to live our values and make sure we are doing what's best for NIU and our students. We don't want to have any instances where we are offering something where it may be an interruption in that student's life cycle because we now have to pull an award or restructure something that causes something or hardship to a student. So we're trying to be proactive as possible, but the ground is still shifting. We're still trying to figure it out. But again, all of the people who are on the front lines of this work, we are all been talking through since June, and I think we have a good handle on a plan of action. Also, I've been in conversation with the IBHE and the governor's office, and the state of Illinois is in the same position of leading with values. So we've not been tested, but that time may come. I'm not afraid of a lawsuit, but at the same time, I don't want to invite one because it takes resources away from the work we need to be doing for our students and for our faculty. So that's where we are now. I just want to give you an introduction to it, and always happy to talk further. If you have specific questions or programmatic things that you're looking at, you have questions and wonder if this case will impact it, happy to talk to you anytime. And again, I'm available just to want to get to know me. So then I'll turn it back to you. I don't know if you have Q&A or just want to do a presentation or.
Yeah, we'll open it up to see if there's any questions from the floor.
See, Felicia has a question.
How does this impact scholarships that are given by private donors that are race-based?
We're not dealing with the private, anything outside of NIU.
I'm talking about that are given like through the foundation that target.
Right now we're trying to catalog those, but external funding that we did not set the criteria on, we're not doing anything with those yet because we don't control those criteria. We're making a note of them in case something changes and that award is no longer offered. There are some that are offered by the state that still use race as a component. We're kind of the pass-through of awarding the money to the student. We're noting them in case they change, but because we didn't set the criteria, we're not going to any external funding sources and saying, you must change, you must do something else.
So I'm wondering about how they decide whether or not your targeted populations are being given preferential treatment. Because it seems to me if it's outcome based, for example, if you target a black high school and you just happen to be accepting good candidates from a black high school, there happen to be more black students coming from that school than other schools. The outcome based is how we actually, that's how we talk about institutional racism. And most of the time that's not allowed. You have to have intent. So I guess I'm wondering what the DOE is thinking in its guidelines. Is it working on intent or is it working on outcomes? And boy, if it's outcomes, that would be interesting.
It really is on how you read the language. It's very interesting that depending on how you see the use of race, I think holistically, depends on how you read the advice and the guidance. For some who were opposed to using race in any way at all, they look at the Department of Ed guidance as an attempt to work around and saying these are workarounds, but you're still using race and they really are illegal. And they are challenging some of the advice from the Department of Ed because they think it's really still not grounded in colorblind admissions. For those who see it more expansive, they see that this is fine. But I can tell you in more conservative states and universities, they would still use, if you picked a zip code which had more disadvantaged students, high minority populations, they would say, you're just using this as a pretext to get around race. Although it's not been struck down, and in Illinois, I think, again, the governor's leading my values. Right now, we're a blue state. But there are states that will look at that and say, nope, this is a pretext for race, and you're just trying to get around what the law says. So it really is interesting. That's what I mean. It's very murky and depends. And so what typically happens in any type of case, the best fact scenario is the case that gets advanced, to hopefully to get to the court, to get the ruling you want. And so I think you'll see a number of challenges throughout the state, and many of them will come from states that already have banned race-based admissions, and they'll pick examples to try to advance, to close the loops that we have open from the previous opinion in SFA.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing with us.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to our next item for faculty consideration. That is the academic diversity, equity, inclusion. It's all in the name. We have three guest speakers with us today. So please come on up. Excited to have you with us today.
We did not purposely plan to have these presentations back to back, but as coincidence or timing would have it, here we are. I am Dr. Carol Sumner, Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer. My two colleagues with me, one may be a new face to some, many of you here. Another is a familiar face as a faculty. We're going to split our time going through this presentation. I'm aware we have 10 minutes and we are passionate people who can speak ad nauseum, but I'm going to time myself. Purposely selecting this title, Academic Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, it's all in the name, because we are really focused on the institution as an academic enterprise and how we're incorporating diversity, equity, and inclusion into the practices across the institution. So our overview today is looking at DEI in context. It is understanding how we as an institution are specifically situated. It's understanding DEI as a part and incorporated into the academic enterprise, advancing the work, talking about the Truth, Racial Healing, and Reconciliation Center, and then engaging, supporting, and serving our communities. One of the things that's really important for us as practitioners, and given what we just heard, it's no surprise that we're finding that the conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion have been in the highlighted stories and features because there has been a premise now established that DEI is really about race. I'm gonna pull this off because I'm not one who can stand behind a podium. Sorry. Tell me when 5 minutes gets up. It's really important to understand there are a lot of other factors that we have to consider when we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so I'm just gonna give you a few of them. First gen, rural, low SES, Pell eligible. None of those are race-based. Minoritized, again, doesn't have to be race-based. It can be sexual orientation or gender as minoritized. Underrepresented can be any number of things, underserved, etc. So when we're framing diversity, equity, and inclusion, My hope, as I have come into this role, is that we're considering the multiple facets of who we are as people, not only about our race, because our race does not always continue to be a factor in some environments. When I'm in my Black community, my race is common, but there can be issues within my community given my gender. So I want you to think more broadly about it. I also want you to think about the state of Illinois. Jade and I were talking with one of our former colleagues, and she sent us the new fact sheet from our former institution about the things they can't do. So we need to understand within the state of Illinois, it is a priority for our governor and leadership within the state that diversity is a value, that equity is a value. It is not compromised. It should not be something that is secondary, and it is a driver for every state organization and entity, including higher education, which is why we have a statewide equity plan. If you're not familiar, Northern Illinois University helped drive that being something as a priority because we as an institution, under the previous vice president and chief diversity officer, Vernice Edgell Walden, recognizing that and working with the president and the senior leadership at the institution, equity was a priority. So we have as a state an equity plan. Every institution must submit. DeKalb and Chicago, we live in a rural community in the shadow of one of the largest cities in the United States. What are the binaries? And then what are the multiple facets that bring to this campus a very different and unique experience that other institutions that may be situated in a rural environment or in a near rural environment don't have the benefit of a large sprawling urban environment? And then lastly, looking at shared equity leadership, this is not an institutional practice that is new. It is several years in the making. So when we talk about diversity, it's about who's represented and how we go about doing this. You all heard me, some of you heard me, a few weeks ago in another faculty senate meeting when I was talking about the difference between asset base and deficit base. When we talk previously about diversity, it was, oh, you were so fortunate to be here. You have hair. We understand how challenging that is to have to get up and comb it every day because you've overcome that challenge. And I'm being facetious and yet real. Oh, you just, God, you're so lucky to be here. That's not the way we're practicing now. The way we're looking at it is an asset. You have done something remarkable to be here, given all of the other factors that society structures, practices, policies have done or have put in place to keep you from being here. How did you overcome those? And then how do we help the next person that's asset-based? We're also looking at the power of the person, but the problems are the policies and the procedures, so we don't problematize the people. Serving this as an institution, where am I with time? A little over five. Okay, serving this, Jade's gonna get to, an R2 institution does not compromise care for students. And we have a lot of individuals that struggle with the institution being an R2. It is not a compromise on our care for students. It does prioritize and recognize the value of research and scholarship. And the last is the intersectional approach for engaging everyone. So I'm going to hand this over to your new colleague, Jade Silva-Tovar, who's going to talk about our HSI designation.
I'm the middle baton, so I'll hurry up. It's part of our HSI designation. Part of the work is really understanding and adapting to who we are as an institution and as an emerging institution, but as we seek out the actual designation, both as a Hispanic serving institution and an R2 institution. And so what does this mean in terms of our servingness framework? And so as we think about servingness, how are we intentionally serving not only our Hispanic Latinx students, but our minoritized, marginalized students, our first generation, Pell eligible, rural communities, because those are all factors as we look at the HSI designation of the intentional things that we can do. And so working alongside our faculty, What does our academic coursework, pathways, curriculums look like for our students, where they see themselves represented in your courses? What does that mean for our access, our persistence? What are those barriers that we've may unintentionally have at the institution that make it harder for students to persist to graduation? What are the career outcomes? How are we connecting with the community, with industry, in very intentional ways as we even think about partnering with industry? How are we then creating an environment of servingness and intentional embeddedness in that throughout the academic co-curricular experience, so when students go into their career environments, they're also having that same experience? And so that's a part of this work. It's also looking at how are we working with students to have a civic engagement, global experiences that speak to their needs, but also the needs of the communities that they're going to be working in. And it's also looking at leadership development. And so really reframing, what does an intentional leadership development mean for our students that may speak multiple languages, and embedding their families as part of that process? And so how are we not only being a serving this to our students, but their families, and families really with students with families and the families of those students? And so how are we creating those environments here at NIU?
We have those. I'm just going to kind of move through quickly. SEM 2.0, if you haven't seen the emails, if you're not a part of it, please do. There are 6 work groups. We are working purposefully to address some of the concerns. Faculty success, student success, one of the drivers. The other is the ILEA equity plan. That is the state plan that I was talking about. Every institution is required to do one. We will be working on ours here.
All right. This will be the work quickly so Dr. Flynn has time. Across NIU is this Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Center. So those of you that may have attended the Real Talk Conference back in October, thank you. We hope to be able to do that every year. And then looking at, are there things throughout the year that we might be able to do in expanding that work? Are we engaging our middle school students, our high school students, especially locally in that process? And then we've launched our Give Circles, which are opportunities to grow in inclusive vulnerability and empathy. And so this Friday, there is a session for faculty and staff. This is really an opportunity to learn through listening as well as empathy in varied experiences for individuals participating in those. And so we hope if you haven't signed up to attend, feel free to do that. But in the spring, we'll be launching additional sessions, and some more will be coming regarding the Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Center work.
Hi, everybody. So our FACE initiative, Faculty Academy for Cultural Competence and Equity, we've been meeting regularly once a month. You do have to register because there is a cap on how many people that we are allowing into the sessions. And that's just to make sure that we have high quality sessions where there's a lot of engagement, a lot of discussion, and the ability to, you know, connect and collaborate with others. We actually have our next session on December 8th. Thank you. December 8th. And it's going to be interesting because it is about teaching with a growth mindset and alternative or equitable assessment practices. And I think this is important because I'm coming to find that we often think about equity-based practices through the lens of what am I teaching, what topics or concepts am I teaching. We call that content integration, and that's only really part of what these practices are about. And what I and other colleagues of mine, like Simone Weffer, of course, and Eric Kunko, the directors of diversity for CLAS and education respectively, we've been talking a lot about trying to shift this conversation away from just about equity practice and think about best practice. What are the best practices based on research that we know of in education that is empowering and supportive and helpful of not only minority students or minoritized students, but also white students as well? So we think that these sessions are helpful and in promoting those kinds of practices.
And one of the things I do want to share, because we're at time, is that Dr. Flynn, as a part of the kind of the overarching work that we are looking to do, not within the cultural centers, but across ADEI, as we're exploring what diversity, equity, and inclusion looks like under social justice. So I want you to imagine social justice is not just race. It can be sustainability. It can be environmental. It can be any number of other practices that have not previously been explored. We're doing the same thing with prevention, education, and outreach. What does prevention mean? It's not just sexual violence prevention. There are other avenues. So as faculty, I would ask you to explore some of the maybe preconceived or established notions you have around the things that we're doing. And if you see something or want to explore a topic, please let us know. We're interested in really trying to represent the work, not just of what's happening across the nation, but specifically what are our needs here at NIU. And we sincerely appreciate your time. We are grateful for all the things that we have moving forward, but we look forward to doing more things in the future. Any questions?
As folks may come up, I just want to make sure to say welcome to Jade. I had the opportunity to meet you today at Joe's talk over lunch today, so it was just a great opportunity to meet you. Glad to have you here on campus.
Wow, I'm not Brian, so I don't have questions. Well, we're here, and if you ever have any questions, have any needs, we see ourselves as senior educators, always trying to be a resource. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you so much. All right, moving to the reports from councils, boards, and standing committees. Our first report will be from the Faculty Advisory Council to the IBHE. I think I saw Linda. Do you have a report? There she is.
Right, it's a long walk, huh? Yeah, good afternoon. My report's not near as interesting as what we just heard from those two presentations, but here we go. Let's see, on November 17th, our meeting was hosted by Northeastern Illinois University, and we had a brief welcome by their provost, who boasted NEIU as one of the most diverse campuses where students can graduate with the least amount of debt. Following the provost's warm welcoming remarks was a presentation by Jennifer Foster at ICCB, Illinois Council and Community, wait, what is it, Illinois Council? Community College Board, there we go. And she highlighted the ICCB's focus on college prep and transferability. As one example, Jennifer talked about the need to provide greater access to dual credit by expanding it to underserved and underrepresented students, particularly in rural and low-income areas where students may have limited access. She also discussed competency-based instruction and a new workforce equity initiative, which includes short-term certificates and accelerated time to completion around high-demand areas. Interesting talk. Jennifer Delaney, who's our IBHE faculty rep, announced that she is stepping down because she will be accepting a position at UC Berkeley starting in January. Illinois or California, which one would you choose, Ben, right? She suggested that we continue to ask for more visibility with the IBHE, that we ask the board to respond not only to undergraduates, but also graduates in research, and that we push forward with ideas on faculty recruitment, retention, and diversity. We then had a mid-morning presentation about NEIU's University Without Walls Stateville program. I don't know if anybody's heard about this. After a gap of 25 years, the University Without Walls program was brought back to Statesville Correctional Center in 2017. It's a non-traditional degree program in partnership with Chicago's Prison Plus Neighborhood Arts Education program. And the program graduated 7 students in their first cohort, and in 2020, they welcomed 5 inmates into their second cohort. So congratulations to them. And then in my College Affordability and Student Debt Working Group that afternoon, we drafted a summary of our work over the past few semesters. And the summary includes information on the Nevada Promise Scholarship and the Tennessee Promise Scholarship, as well as statistics on middle-class student debt. So if you would like to see the full summary, please just let me know. Okay, and that concludes my report. Any questions? I don't get questions usually. It's all right. better that way, right? I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Next up is the University Advisory Committee to the Board of Trustees report. The Board of Trustees met on November 9th to engage with a variety of topics through their three main committees. I want to highlight a few items from the meeting, but once again, I encourage you to review the BOT reports ahead of those Board of Trustee meeting dates. There's often a lot of great information that's shared, of which I can only share a little bit today. First of all, there's a new trustee, Leland Strom, who's joined the Board of Trustees. So he was welcomed. The Finance Audit Compliance Facilities and Operations Committee heard a series of reports related to NIU's finances. They also heard recommendations and approved the state budget request, the IBHE capital budget request, and a number of upgrade repairs or replacement requests from across campus, as well as a few other expenditures. The Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee received updates on academic program reviews. And they also heard a presentation from Drs. Melissa Lencheski and Christine Mooney about their transdisciplinary multi-institutional work to develop BASICS, which stands for Business and Science Integrated Curriculum for Sustainability. This PowerPoint is available online on the Board of Trustees website. I personally found it extremely compelling and really interesting work. If you'd like to take a look at their presentation, but it shared the process for how they developed transdisciplinary curriculum, the intent, the time intensiveness, the resource intensiveness of it. And then they really highlighted the effect of this curriculum on student learning and then what they learned as faculty members from multiple institutions about faculty motivation to do transdisciplinary work, as well as the barriers facing engaging in transdisciplinary work. The Board of Trustees were extremely engaged with the presentation and stated their desire to support and elevate this type of work. And that's, you know, it's great to hear the Board of Trustees being so engaged in that type of innovative, truly innovative development of transdisciplinary curriculum. They expressed their willingness to support and elevate that type of work. The Research, Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Affairs Committee received reports from VP for RIPS, Yvonne Harris, and AVP, Dara Little. In those reports, there's recognition of Dara Little for her work at the university and across her professional communities. Highlighting a couple of faculty members, including Dr. Skaczynski's work with the Illinois Innovation Network and Dr. Tao Lee's work and new membership at Argonne National Research Center. Senior leadership also presented on some of the themes that NIU took to IBHE's conversation during the annual Big Picture meeting, where NIU and IBHE were able to engage in a conversation, and it was focused on showing how NIU's efforts are aligned with the growth strategies that IBHE has for the states. And they also shared legislative priorities, and I wanted to just to flag that one of the legislative priorities echoes what was shared at our last Faculty Senate meeting by Brendan Swedlow about regulatory reform. And so that was nice to hear that sort of through point and connection that there's a lot of different aspects of legislation that are being advocated for reform by our institution, including flexibility for some of the scholarship dollars that our students receive through MAP and AIM High. Once again, I encourage folks to read the minutes or attend parts of those meetings. They really truly are informative of what's going on in our university and across the state. And that concludes that report. Next up, we do not have a report from the Baccalaureate Council, which brings us to the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee, which is me again, sorry. But the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee met on November 6th. They were charged with reviewing NIU's current policies and comparing those with best practices, and also reviewing current trainings related to two topics. The first was sexual misconduct, and the second was academic freedom. This group will be providing recommendations to me about what priorities we should have, what sort of policies may be needed or refined within the university, and help inform conversations that I'm engaged with across campus. And those will be made to me in the spring semester and then shared with this body at the same time. And that concludes the report from the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee. We have no reports from Social Justice Committee or the FS UC Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee. For the Student Government Association, we have a report. So I'd like to welcome up Christopher English, please, to the microphone. You can come up and use the lectern or the one there. Thank you.
Hello. So I just wanted to tell you all what's happening with SGA, the Student Government Association, right now. We're hosting the State of the Student Government Association for the fall semester, December 5th at 3:30 in the Carl Sandburg Auditorium in the Holmes Student Center. So that's kind of give a much more in-depth update of what we've been doing over this semester and the progress we've made. To that point, we've approved and recognized over 30 new student organizations who've come to us seeking that recognition. So there's now 30 new, or more than 30 now, student organizations who've been recognized on campus. We are currently in the process of voting on adding co-training as a requirement for student organization leadership, having two members at least go to co-training. We are also working on making sure our HR policy is being properly implemented so it can properly benefit the most students. And finally, during the week of finals, we will be handing out goodie bags to de-stress and kind of help with all of that final stuff, as well as trying to get feedback from students during that week.
Thank you so much, Christopher, and appreciate you being here to share with that. And I look forward to continued conversations with SGA. Thank you. Up next is Operating Staff Council. There's no report. Supported Professional Staff Council. Felicia.
We're really focused on increasing engagement with SPSS staff, and so we have a number of upcoming activities. On the 4th at 3 p.m., we have a trivia event at Fatty's, and we're inviting faculty as well as everyone else on campus. So it's an SPSS activity, but that starts at 3 o'clock. And Kathy Doderlein is our game host. So we'd like to encourage you to come out and participate. We also are looking at having a professional development session on December 14th. And the focus of that is on SPSS sabbaticals. And we're sending out information to all SPSS staff concerning that. That will take place at 11:30. We also have begun to accept applications for the SPSS scholarship. And as previously mentioned, that is for either a child or a grandchild of an SPSS employee, but also someone who is mentored by an SPSS employee. And then lastly, we have begun to accept applications for our SPSS Professional Staff Award. The deadline for that is February 16th. At this point, the committee is accepting names, so you do not have an extensive process in terms of applying or nominating someone. If you send us their name along with one or two sentences, that's all we're asking for at this time. And that information is on the SPSS website. Thank you.
Thank you, Felicia. Our next report is the University Benefits Committee by Cynthia Campbell.
Thank you. The University Benefits Committee met on November 2nd, and I'm brand new to the committee. It was my first meeting. I found it very interesting, and I learned a lot. So I'm just going to announce some of the things that we talked about during that meeting. And if you have any questions, I may not know the details because I'm brand new, but here goes. Okay, so one of the benefits was for staff. There is an ad pay for degree completion. There's also been a change of the direct deposit. Now it's okay if you want your direct deposit to go to more than one account. Now, how you set that up, I don't know, but that's a change, and that was found to be beneficial to some. There's open enrollment. You've probably received information about this, with Prudential as a supplement on top of the CSRS benefit. You have to have 2 years of service to be able to be eligible for that, and see the HR website for details. In January of 2024, the 403B changes. It's going up to $500 for contributions. So that announcement's going out the end of the year. The Pay Leave for All Act is going into effect January of 2024. And what this is it provides all Illinois employees with 40 hours of paid time in a 12-month period. This is in addition to sick and vacation time and can be used for any reason. However, it cannot be cashed out and it cannot be carried forward. So after the 12-month time, that 40 hours, if not used, goes away, but it'll come back for the next round. Also, the parental care time or the leave for a child is approximately 5 weeks, 187.5 hours. This is something I didn't know that's coming up. The sick bank benefit choice registration opens up in October for temporary instructors and May for everyone else. You have to contribute to be a bank member, and members can access the bank up to 45 days. So my understanding is that if for some catastrophe happens and you don't have enough sick time, you, if you're a member of the sick bank, you can withdraw sick time from those that others have contributed. Going forward, we're going to continue to discuss how to balance the juxtaposition between benefits and the university deficit. We're going to continue to examine benefits for each group, and we're getting ready to benchmark the bereavement benefits compared to other universities in the MAC conference. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. Looks like we have a comment.
Real quick, John Boswell with SBS. I'm the chair of the Benefits Committee. Just wanted to clarify the staff pay for degree completion. That was just brought up to John Accardo about the status of it. It was something that was brought up in the past. So there's nothing about, yeah.
All right, thank you for that clarification. I'm sure John will appreciate that.
And like I said, I may not know the whole story because it was my first meeting, so thank you, John.
All right, thank you. So that concludes the reports for today, which brings us to item 11, which is information items. A through O are various minutes in the policy library. So if you're looking for the baccalaureate council minutes related to the gen ed decision route pathways, there's a quick link for it. You'll see item P is our upcoming schedule. Our next meeting won't be until the next calendar year, January 24th. So if I don't see you between now and then, I wish you great holidays and great break. We have item Q is the fall commencement. Just a reminder of the two dates, Saturday and Sunday, December 16th and 17th. There was a recent request for volunteers for commencement. If you're not already planning to go or serve in some way, please do consider volunteering or also just lending your body and support to those who have completed their time with us at NIU and their degree, and honor that moment for them. And before we move to adjournment, is there?
Yeah, thank you. Brendan Swethell, Political Science. I just wanted to follow up on the your comments at the beginning about the budget and transparency and the previous budget presentation, which I took that back. We had a discussion in our department, basically, and I came back with a question to if we could get information on the, I think it was 54% of the current budget goes to personnel, and if we could get that broken down by types of personnel and just see where that's going, not only this year, but sort of the trend in that over some period of time. So we could see, sort of meaningfully what the trends have been in where that, that 54, more than half of our budget is going to personnel. What the trends in that are, that would be great. Something my department was interested in, also other people I've talked about. And I can make that a little more pointed in that people I've talked to are, there's an impression that administrative salaries are a larger part of the budget or something like that over time, that there's kind of a growth happening there within an overall shrinking budget environment. And We'd just like to see if that's the case or not and have a discussion about that, if possible.
Right. Yeah, thank you for that. And I think that's something I can talk with George and others about. I know we're planning to come in the spring, have him come back and share information. Maybe that's something either at that setting or through a conversation that we can facilitate to pull that information together and see what sort of data we can have to share. Thank you for the comment.
All right, thank you.
All right, that brings us to item 12, which is adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn? David, second? Second? All in favor? All right, thank you.